sidelines, a senior Iranian military commander says Israel will pay the price for the assassination of prominent Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. New Chief Ursula von der Leyen says the probability of a no deal with Britain is higher than that of a deal. And German officials say the country will have to impose tougher coronavirus restrictions before Christmas to try to get the pandemic under control. Hello and welcome, everybody. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says Israel will pay the price for the assassination of prominent Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. In a meeting with Fakhrizadeh's family members, IRGC's chief commander said Iran will take revenge on Israel and its stooges in due time. Major General Hossein Salami added that the Israeli regime is edging closer to collapse with such inhuman acts. He said the loss of such great figures is painful for Iran, but their assassination is a testament to the crimes committed against the country. Salami noted that the enemies of the Islamic Republic are unable to tolerate such committed and expert scientists. The IRGC chief said Iran would carry on their work more resolutely. Fakhrizadeh was assassinated late last month when his car was ambushed near the Iranian capital, Tehran. Political analyst Sameti Torabi says Iran's revenge for the assassination of its nuclear scientists will involve both tactical and strategic measures.
Iran will take revenge tactically and also strategically. Tactically, in terms of responding to this attack and this murder, and strategically, of course, with the plan that Iran has over the next decade in order of. As it relates to ending Israel, which we've talked about many times before. When we talk about collapse of Israel or when we talk about the end of Israel, this doesn't mean any sort of, driving the Jews into the sea or some other propaganda that is being told by the Zionists to everybody in the world. What it means is that Israel, the Zionist apartheid state, will no longer exist, and there will be a Palestinian republic in which Muslims, Jews, Christians live as equal citizens. This is the ultimate revenge and the strategic goal. And this is something that most rational people understand, even many of the Jews that live in this racist apartheid Zionist state realize that there's no future continuing this failed Zionist project. And in terms of what Iran will do, in terms of tactically, well, Iran has shown over the last 40 years that it is very smart in the decisions it makes in terms of what it does in these situations, and certainly it won't do something that will in any way endanger its strategic goals. And it will be painful, and it will be something that, everybody will get the message of the revenge.
Palestinians have condemned a normalization agreement between Israel and Morocco. They say the deal will increase Israel's belligerence and its denial of the rights of the Palestinian people. Morocco is the fourth Arab country to normalize ties with Israel after the UAE, Bahrain, and Sudan. The details in this following report.
Morocco has become the fourth Arab country to normalize relations with Israel since August in a U.S. brokered agreement. U.S. President Donald Trump announced the agreement on Twitter Thursday. He said Rabat and Tel Aviv have agreed to fold diplomatic relations, calling the move a historic breakthrough. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu also called the deal historic. Morocco said under the agreement it will take concrete steps to resume a relationship with Israel on several levels. In return, the U.S. decided to recognize Morocco's sovereignty over the entire Western Sahara. The Polisario Front independence movement that holds a fifth of the region strongly condemned the deal. The movement said Trump has attributed to Morocco something that does not belong to the country. Palestinians denounced the agreement too. The Palestine Liberation Organization said Morocco's decision was unacceptable. It said the move will increase Israel's belligerence and its denial of the Palestinian people's rights. Resistance movement Hamas said Israel uses every new normalization deal to increase its aggression against Palestinians. The Islamic Jihad movement also denounced Morocco's decision as a betrayal to the Islamic and Arab world. In Yemen, the Ansarullah movement said there isn't any justification for Arab states to establish ties with Israel. Inside Morocco, many people are critical of normalization with Israel. During a demonstration in the capital Rabat in September, protesters called Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates treacherous countries for establishing diplomatic relations with Israel. Many believe U.S. brokered normalization agreements aim to eliminate Palestinians from the entire region.
Israel doesn't want peace. Israel wants territory, power, and it wants genocide. It wants to eliminate Palestinians, preferably 100%. If not by killing them, then by making them forget that they're Palestinian.
The UAE announced its decision to establish diplomatic ties with Israel in August. In return, Washington provided Abu Dhabi with F-35 fighter jets. Bahrain and Sudan followed suit, with Sudan being removed from the U.S. blacklist of terrorism-sponsored countries. On Thursday, White House senior advisor Jared Kushner said a similar deal is inevitable between Israel and Saudi Arabia. For now, it's unclear what privileges Riyadh will be given to normalize relations with Tel Aviv.
Russia has denounced new U.S. sanctions against a number of Russian entities, saying they will deepen a crisis in bilateral ties.
The actions of the U.S. administration are just another unfriendly and detrimental move against Russia, which will deepen the crisis in bilateral relations. The allegations that Russian officials are responsible for human rights violations are groundless and beneath criticism.
The Russian ambassador called the sanctions an attempt by the U.S. to distract public attention from its own problems. The new measures target a number of Russian officials and firms over what the U.S. calls links to the Chechen leader. The measures were announced by the U.S. Treasury Department on Thursday. It has accused the targeted entities of human rights violations, including torture. The U.S. had previously blacklisted Chechen leader Ramzan Kadyrov on similar accusations. On this news review, a senior Yemeni official has condemned U.S. sanctions against some officials of the country's National Salvation Government, calling them an act of terrorism. Muhammad Ali al-Houthi said the sanctions are illegal since the U.S. has no right to impose restrictions on other nations. The Ansarullah official also denounced Washington for leading aggression and attacks on Yemeni people and neglecting Security Council orders. Earlier, the U.S. Treasury blacklisted five Yemeni officials who cooperate with the country's security and intelligence services. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Yemeni activist and political commentator Hossein Al-Wahaiti, who's joining us from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. Also, we have former humanitarian aide to Yemen, Ms. Judith Brown, who's joining us from Bristol. Welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Al-Wahaiti in Sana'a. Give us your thoughts on this recent act by the United States.
As you mentioned, that Muhammad Ali al-Houthi, head of the popular committee in Sana'a, has said that this is an act of terrorism, and he has mentioned what about George Floyd that was killed by police brutality in the United States. There are hundreds of American citizens who are killed in the same way every year. I want to add as well, what about Khashoggi, who was actually a journalist who was chopped to death by Saudis in their consulate in Turkey? And what about more than 300,000 Yemeni civilians who are killed by the blockade that's enforced by the United States and the Saudi coalition on Yemen for almost 6 years? I mean, according to UNICEF, one child dies every 10 minutes because of preventable diseases. I mean, we haven't had of this kind of preventable diseases like the cholera, malaria, and as well the starvation that's actually hitting hard the Yemeni children. This is all because the United States policy in Yemen. And we see in this latest treasury list, they actually mainly focus on countries that are against the United States policy in Yemen. And I want to just add that in the treasury list, I believe years ago, United States has bought four Yemenis, as they say, Al-Qaeda and ISIS and Nusra, fundraiser or collaborators with those terrorist group, and those people like Naif al-Gaisi, Khalid al-Irada, and al-Hassan Ali Abkar and Abdul Wahab al-Humaygani, they are, some of them are in Saudi Arabia, some of them are appointed by Hadi government to be the governor either of Al-Bayda, and some of them are leading the Saudi-backed forces fight against Sana'a forces, and they are in the treasury list for in the terrorist list. So what about those people? In they just put names in that list, and then they will support anyone who will fight either Sana'a or either any country that's against the U.S. policy. And we've seen in this latest list that they have focused on the Yemeni security and intelligence and criminal investigation service. I just want to mention that, for example, for Zabin, who was mentioned in this treasury list, he's the head of criminal investigation. The U.S. said that he have abused women, and actually he's the opposite. He has exposed a gang who actually exploit Yemeni women, blackmail Yemeni women, which led in some cases to rape. And he have exploited this group. He have exploited one of the largest drug gang in Yemen who were actually using Yemen as a ground to receive drugs from around the world and to send it into the Gulf state. So this guy actually is protecting the Gulf country from the invasion of drugs that come in through Yemen. And they show you that the United States, actually, they don't want this to happen in Yemen. They want Yemen to be a country without any law, a country with drug, with crime to spread in many areas, especially areas under the control of Sana'a government.
Judith Brown, what do you think are the objectives of these U.S. sanctions?
Well, I think, first of all, you've got to think of the situation in America, because, as you know, there's possible political change in the White House, and maybe the person who's leaving might want to make the situation more difficult for the incumbent by bringing in sort of new designations. I gather they've been trying to designate the Houthis a terrorist group, which so far they haven't been able to do, although even if they do, I don't know exactly what difference that will make. They've designated other groups like Hezbollah and Hamas terrorist groups, and it hasn't actually made any significant difference. So I think that in terms of what they're trying to achieve, I think the policies of America are unfathomable. Who can work out what exactly they're trying to do? But as the last speaker said, there's all of the actors who are fighting in Yemen have got a very unclean record. Certainly, there are groups, for example, someone who's in the STC has been known to be associated with Al-Qaeda, Hani bin Brek, but nobody has designated him, given him any special designation. So I think all of these things are political. But as you know, the world is divided into those who follow the American hegemonic line and those who don't. And I think that there's always been an independent streak in the nature of Yemenis, and hence they're always going to be punished, as we've seen throughout the last few decades.
Judith Brown, has the international community failed the people of Yemen?
Well, I think when you talk about the people, I think that one of the difficulties is that Yemen is virtually unknown. It very rarely appears on our news. For example, every now and then they pop up and say Yemen is, there's this famine in Yemen, and everybody seems very sorry, and it's almost as if the famine is existing on its own. Every now and then there's something about the bombs that fall on Yemen, British bombs, but actually that's becoming less and less common in the newspapers now as the media sort of winds on with the latest stories, COVID and other things. And of course, every time there's a peace treaty, they announce the peace treaty, and then everybody in the Western world thinks, oh, well, they've got peace now. They've signed a peace treaty in Stockholm or Riyadh, and now Yemen's, everything's fine in Yemen. So I think the actual people don't really know very much about Yemen. But I think that the media certainly has let down Yemen a great deal by ignoring it, by ignoring ex- extremely big news stories, like, for example, when you had the world's biggest cholera outbreak ever, it didn't break on our news. So therefore, I think that the media has been very compliant with the wishes of the leaders of the Western world who lead news stories, and they just don't care about Yemen. They see it as something that's expendable. And at the moment, I think that those in power in the Western world would certainly like Saudi Arabia to and UAE between them to occupy Yemen and to control it, and they don't see Yemen's sovereignty as having any validity whatsoever. Of course, that's exactly different to my view and different to the view of most Yemenis too.
Mr. Abouhaiti, very briefly, if you may, do you agree with Ms. Judith Brown as to the media has also let down the Yemeni people as well?
Yeah, I mean, the media has really let Yemeni people down. We only saw a light about Yemen in the international media only after the killing of Khashoggi. This means that the life of Khashoggi, actually to those media, especially the United Kingdom or the United States, is more important than millions of Yemeni who are under siege, millions who are starving to death, and hundreds of thousands who have been killed either by the blockade or by Saudi direct airstrike using weapons from Western countries like the United States and the UK. But to be honest with you, here the government in Sana'a, they don't care about what the United say or what they release in their treasury list, because the main focus for them is how to liberate Yemen, how to fight terrorism. And as a just final example, in this treasury list, there was the name of Al-Khaywani. He's the head of security and intelligence service. This guy, I mean, he had a great role in wiping out Al-Qaeda and dismantling Al-Qaeda and ISIS in Yemen. So why the United States actually put his name in this list? Because they don't want anyone to succeed in fighting Al-Qaeda like Ansarullah and Sana'a has done, because they want countries to still have Al-Qaeda so the United States will have an excuse to interfere, as they say, to fight terrorism around the world.
All right, thanks a lot. That was Hossein Abouhaiti joining us from Sana'a. Also, thanks to Ms. Judith Brown speaking to us from Bristol. With that, brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. Do stay tuned, though. There's plenty more to come. European Union Chief Ursula von der Leyen has reportedly told the 27-member bloc that there are low expectations that a post-Brexit trade deal could be struck with Britain. EU sources said the bloc leaders heard von der Leyen as saying that the probability of a no deal is higher than that of a deal. The pessimistic tone came after British Prime Minister Boris Johnson also warned of a strong possibility of a no deal. Negotiators from both sides are holding intensive talks in Brussels to see if they could find a way to reach an accord by Sunday. Meanwhile, the EU ruled out its plans for a no-deal Brexit scenario. The two sides remain at loggerheads over a number of issues related to future ties. Britain formally left the bloc in January and has since been in a transition period, which ends on December 31st. COVID-19 is surging through Europe, with several countries on the continent reporting a record high in their daily cases or fatalities. Germany reported nearly 30,000 new cases in 24 hours. That was a record daily number for a second day in a row. New deaths were almost 600. Germany's overall death toll now stands at close to 21,000 out of over 1.2 million cases. The surge in cases has prompted the government to mull a tougher lockdown before Christmas. The Swiss government has ordered the closure of restaurants, shops, and other public places at 7 p.m. daily in hard-hit regions. Most events will also be canceled, with sport and cultural activities being limited to 5 people. This as the country is witnessing a steep rise in COVID infections and deaths. On Friday, authorities reported over 5,100 new cases and 106 deaths. Russia posted a record 613 deaths in 24 hours, pushing the total fatalities to nearly 45,900. Russia's overall COVID cases are almost 2.6 million. In Ukraine, infections increased by 13,500 to over 872,000. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Advertising needs to be controlled and changed to reduce its impact on the climate, according to a report released as consumers prepare to spend billions of dollars on Black Friday. The report by the New Weather Institute think tank and the charity We Are Possible examines how advertising indirectly contributes to climate change and the ecological emergency. The study has found that the advertising industry promotes materialism and lifts sales of climate-harming products. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Sandra Laville. The piece is titled, Rein in Advertising to Help Tackle Climate Crisis, Report Urges. Stay with us for more of Sandra Laville's article. Advertising needs to be controlled and changed to reduce its impact on the climate, according to a report released as consumers prepare to spend billions of dollars on Black Friday. The report by the New Weather Institute think tank and the charity We Are Possible examines how advertising indirectly contributes to climate change and the ecological emergency. The study has found that the advertising industry promotes materialism and lifts sales of climate-harming products. Researchers say the promotion of consumerism, materialism, and a work-and-spend cycle, and the industry's role in pushing sales of beef, tobacco, high-polluting, sports utility vehicles, and flights are all part of that indirect role. The report says the advertising industry has so far escaped scrutiny about its role in contributing to climate change. Tim Kasser, an emeritus professor of psychology at Knox College in Illinois, who co-authored the report, said there was a body of evidence to show that in order to make progress in addressing and reversing climate change and ecological degradation, it will be prudent to rein in and change the practices of the advertising industry. This report argues that enough sound empirical evidence exists to support the conclusion that the advertising industry indirectly contributes to climate change and ecological degradation through its encouragement of materialistic values and goals, the consumption-driven work and spend cycle, and the consumption of two illustrative products, namely beef and tobacco, Kasser wrote. The researchers examined several studies linking exposure to advertising with increased materialism. They say such exposure heightens the priority of people placed on materialistic values and goals and is associated with negative ecological attitudes and unsustainable behaviors. The desire to work longer hours in order to consume more is also laid at the door of advertising. Advertising leads people to place higher value on consumption of what they see advertised and lower value on having more time available for non-work activities, the report says. The advertising industry also encourages the purchase of products that have a negative impact on the environment, such as beef and tobacco. Numerous studies make it clear that raising cattle for beef relies on unsustainable water usage, causes destruction of habitat, habitat-providing and carbon-capturing forests, and emits high levels of both greenhouse gases and chemicals such as phosphorus and nitrogen that cause excessive growth of algae in bodies of water, the report says. Tobacco production also has a direct impact on the environment. Each stage in the life cycle of a cigarette, from growing the tobacco to manufacturing the cigarette to smoking the cigarette to disposing of the cigarette, is associated with specific climate and ecological risks. Deforestation, chemical pollution of water and soil, carbon dioxide and other noxious emissions. Tim Kasser said the correlation between the advertising of tobacco and its consumption was strong enough to have led the World Health Organization to call for a comprehensive ban on tobacco advertising to reduce its consumption. Stephen Woodford, chief executive of the Advertising Association, said, "Banning advertising of certain parts of the economy is not the answer. Applying pressure on systemic change in the way an industry operates is, and recognizing that advertising itself will make the best contribution to climate action by helping promoting these critical changes to people and encourage rapid behavioral change. At the same time, our own industry needs to make sure its operations have a real net zero impact, which is why we have launched Ad Net Zero to reduce the carbon impact of the development, production and distribution of advertising to real net zero by end of 2030. This includes the goal of encouraging advertisers and agencies, advertising agencies, to measure the carbon impact of their campaigns, which is a good and proven first step towards reduction of our impact on the environment.
Face to face. Dear listeners, what you hear now is an interview with Sudanese Information Minister Faisal Mohamad Saleh about ongoing developments in that country.
Thank you for joining us. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to speak to me. It's been 2 years since the Sudanese revolution, since the protests began. What do you think has been the main challenges, and have people's lives significantly changed since the revolution?
I think that the transition itself, it's a challenge. It's a very big challenge for the government, for the Sovereign Council, and for the political parties. And if we study the experience of transitional period in many countries, it's always been a very difficult time with a lot of challenges and obstacles. And we face the same challenges and obstacles here in Sudan. It was difficult even to change the mentality of the people, the ordinary people, the people in the civil service, in the governments, who used to be under dictatorship for, military and dictatorship for 30 years. And at the same time, we have the problems of also changes in the military side, in the security, in the police department, in the army, which they are now partners. So all these were the difficulties we are facing. Some of them are expected already. We expect to have such problems. Some of them are new ones. At the beginning of the revolution and before that, people were hoping that we are going to have a full civilian transitional government and transitional organs. No one expected such situation of multiple military and civilian.
So this is a new challenge. We found ourselves in a position where the civilian are negotiating with the army and they should be both on board. We were not prepared for that. The political parties were not prepared for that. The FFC, which she led the revolution, were not prepared for that. So this was a de facto situation that you have to deal with it. So this has also created new problems. Since this government came, we are trying to deal with these difficulties and challenges. I think we have been successful in some of them, especially, for example, in the side of peace agreement. It was a success, although, of course, some of the armed movement are still out of this peace negotiation. We hope that they're going to join. And the main challenges, I think, was economic one. And I will say, frankly, we were not successful in that. We still have a lot of problems. We knew from the beginning that we are going to have a very difficult economy, the old regime, and we had some ideas that we are going to overcome this problem. Unfortunately, and again, frankly, I will say that we were not successful in overcoming this problem. We're still suffering. Part of it, I think, will be solved because of the lifting of the American sanctions. Part of it, not all of it, but at least it will open doors for investment. It will open door for Sudan to rejoin the international banking system, which is one of the problems we are facing. But this is now is the main challenge, that the economic one.
And something you mentioned was you did not anticipate joining the military. You was expecting a full civilian government.
Yes.
What happened? How have we got to this situation where we have this kind of partnership between the military and the civilian government?
What happened is that simply, that the army intervened when they knew that the revolution will continue, and I think they have reached to the point where they think that the old regime cannot continue. And maybe they were thinking of if a new regime came, then there will be some negative aspects, negative result on the army, so they decided to intervene. So it appeared at the beginning that they are intervening in favor of the civilians, the protesters. But of course, when they did that, they asked for a share of power. And I think this is expected and natural in such situations. We have the same experience in 1985. Where also the army intervened in the last moment, and so they were part of the transitional government. It lasted only for 1 year, but this time here is 4 years. So I think when they intervened, when they took the power and they ousted the old regime, then the civilian FFC found themselves in a situation where they have to negotiate, and they came the intermediate, the African Union intervened, Ethiopia intervened, the mediators came in, and it was a situation, as I said, it's a de facto situation where you have to negotiate with the army. And it was from that day, 11th of April 2019, people expected that the army will be on board with the civilian. The negotiation was what's the share of the army will be and what's the share of the civilians. And I think because of the balance of power, by that time we reached to this result. Again, maybe it was not anticipated, it was not the same, the type of civilian transition government that people were expected, but this is how things went. And so it started from August 2019, this civilian and military partnership.
And it's a process, the transitional period is a process, and at the end of the process, the hope and the aim is for a democratically elected government.
Yes.
But what's to say the army doesn't do the same thing again, and they once again try to share power with a democratically elected government?
I think that will depend on the balance of power. Because we had this, what we call a constitutional declaration, and the constitutional declarations put an end to the military participation by the end of the transitional period, where we should finish the constitution, the new constitution, and we are going to have an election, and of course a new democratic government will take control. And the army will go back to the barracks, will be just doing what the army in the other countries do. This is what the constitutional declaration and the political agreement agreed upon. And I think everything depends on this balance of power, because if the civilians are weak, then maybe the army will have a new ideas. But day after day, there is a progress on that.
And we've traveled to many places on our trips. And one of the places we went to is Mayo, one of the poorest neighborhoods in Khartoum. It seems like the economically disenfranchised, which seems to be getting larger, it seems to be growing. What message can the Transitional Council give to them about economic prosperity in the future, or at least uplifting them from the economic situation that they're in?
That is linked to two issues. One of them is political and the other one is economic. Political one is peace. Most of the people who are living in these areas came from the war-affected areas, and they are live in the margins of the big cities. And also, they don't have, some of them, most of them don't have a skill, they were not educated, so they are doing marginal jobs. And I think if we successful enough in implementing the peace agreement, most of these people will go back to their areas, where they are farmers or whatever the profession they have, and they resettle in their own areas where they have at least some peace and stability. That I think will improve the economic situation of them, because as I said, they will not be in the margin of their own life. They will be in the center of the life they are used to live in the past. So this is a political side, that if we have enough peace and stability and security in the war-affected area, people will go back to these areas and live ordinary life. The other side is the economic one. As I said, we were not successful in that till now, because we promised people of working on sustainable development, and that we are trying to find way where the people will at least find education, health care, without spending a lot of money on that. That would be the government responsibility. And we still, although we promised to start from day one to do that, we didn't fulfill this for them. Because I think most of the problems they have is with education and health care. They are spending a lot of money on that, although they don't have enough money to do that. So this is part of the program the government promised to do, to work on it, free education for all people of Sudan, and free basic health care. And that, as I said, because we were not successful in pulling the country from this economic crisis, we still couldn't do that. I think, as I said again, when with this lifting sanctions, the American sanction of Sudan, now we will be open for receiving help and fund from international finance institution that will help improving the country. Also, I think we are going to receive a lot of investment. Sudan is rich with its resources, natural resources, that will open door for investors. And rejoining the international banking system will also attract investors. I think with new investments, that will help improving the situation in the country, and will improve the situation in these war-affected areas and the marginal areas.
So you mentioned the delisting of Sudan from the state sponsor of terror. Many international observers say that that had less to do with the compensation offered to American victims of terror and more to do with Sudan agreeing to normalize relations with Israel. What was your response?
At the beginning, that was not the case. We have started from day one. In September 2019, the negotiation with the Americans on the political and legal side of this case of delisting Sudan from state sponsoring terrorism, and the compensation for the families of the victims of terrorist act that Sudan, the old Sudan government, was linked to. And the issue of normalizing the relationship with Israel was never, by that time, was never mentioned. It started, as I said, in September 2019. So the negotiation went on the political side with the American administration and with the victims' families, the legal side. And that went on for maybe 7 or 8 months. And it went on successfully until we reached the point where we reduce the amount of money that the Sudan government will pay for the, as a compensation for the victims' families. In the last few months since then, the question of normalization with Israel was raised. And what was not raised only with Sudan, as you may say, with Emirates, with Bahrain, with other countries. And we insisted on two things, that separation of the two issues. We used to say to them, and that was said to Secretary of State Bami when he came to Sudan, that these are two separate issues. Delisting Sudan from SST, we are negotiating on that in 7 or 8 months. Normalization with Israel is a very controversial issue. It could be discussed, of course. There's no problem in that, in discussing it in Sudanese media or discussion with the public, whatever it is. It could be discussed, but separated from the delisting of Sudan from SST. This is number one. Number two, our response to him was that we are a transitional government. This issue is not one of our mandate. And that is what we agreed upon in the civilian government with the FFC. We had a joint meeting before he, a day before he came, and we agreed that this is not a part of our mandate as a transitional government. This should be left to an elected government to discuss it. Then the American pressure on Sudan started. Until that time, he didn't say that it was linked, the delisting with the normalization. But he used to raise the issues. Until maybe the last 2 weeks before the American election. And I think it was, Sudan was used as a card in the elections. Trump wanted to have some cards in his favor. Part of it is convincing some Arab countries to normalizing relationship with Israel. So it was linked directly. Sudan was put under a very heavy pressure. In the last week it was said clearly, this is linked. If you want Sudan to be listed, delisted from the SST, then you have to normalize the relationship with Israel. It was a very difficult situation. And the economic expert, our economics expert, our economic minister said that Sudan cannot tolerate the sanction for 7 or 2 months after election. If we said no, then we will wait for the election, then the new administration will have 6, 7, 8 months until they have done all the heavy duty that they are supposed to do, the homework, until they can discuss things with Sudan. This is a very long time Sudan cannot tolerate. So the government had to do that, had to promise that they are going to normalize the relationship with Israel, but there was one condition. The whole issue will go to the Legislative Council. The Legislative Council is supposed to be established in a few weeks, that the whole issue of normalizing the relationship with Israel will go to the Legislative Council. If it is approved by the Legislative Council, then the formal step will start. So that was the agreement until the election. We all watched what happened in the American election. And now I think that the issue of delisting will go on because the Democrats in the Congress approved it before even the election. So there was no problem in delisting Sudan from that. We are confident that this issue will go on successfully. The only issue still left is Sudan should be given some type of immunity from future cases, because paying compensation to these families may be that it will open door for some other families. and some of the senators have raised the issue of September 11 victims. They said that some of the families want also to sue Sudan. So this is, will be something that endless process. And we have said many times, even in the agreement, when we signed the agreement to pay the compensation for the families in Sudan, actually Sudanese people have nothing to do with terrorism. And that was an act of an ousted government. And it is not fair that Sudanese people should continue paying the price of that, for that. Because the old regime hurt Sudanese people more than they hurt the American or the people of other countries. So we shouldn't pay the price twice. We have paid the price for 30 years. And now there is a new democratic government. It is suffering to try to take the country in the transitional process. It should be held by the whole world and by the American administration not to be punished for crime committed in the old, by the old regime. We hope that the new administration will be open. We are also optimistic that the new administration will consider that. At least the Democrats say that they are more concerned with the democracy and human rights in the world. And I think if they want to present Sudan as a model for the region, they should help Sudan improving the situation of human rights and democracy. And that, of course, will be one of the conditions if you want to promote democracy in the region, to help the new democratic regime like Sudan.
And do you think the economic situation, the long queues for bread, for fuel, do you think that was used by the Americans as a negotiation tactic to force Sudan to normalize relations?
I cannot say that directly, but at least they didn't help Sudan to overcome such problems. It was not created by the Americans, maybe they are not used directly, but at least the Sudan was not helped in trying to overcome these economic problems.
And one of the issues that has come up is accountability. One of the most infamous parts of the revolution was the June the 3rd massacre. Yet when I've spoken to different people, they have very little hope that there'll ever be accountability for those that ordered the killings. What would you say to those people?
We are working hard on that. It's a very difficult task. Very, very difficult task. We have formed an independent committee to investigate what happened on the 3rd of June, and it's working with difficulties. And they have asked for extension for their... They were given 3 months, and then they asked for extension for 3 months, and now we are in the third extension of the 3 months. They are complaining of that. They have almost about 3,000 witnesses. They have listened to 3,000 witnesses. They have hundreds of videotapes that they are looking and try to verify. And the task is very difficult. They are facing a very difficult time. They are working in a very difficult situation, and we understand that. And we try to explain to that to the people. It is not an easy task. It needs some time. We should give them the time they ask for, so that when they finish their reports, the reports will be a very convincing report. So they have to spend the time they ask for. This is one thing. But in other cases, there is now ongoing trials on some of the martyrs of the revolution. Said there is now about 5 trials going on. In Al-Ubayyid, and here in Khartoum, in Al-Hasahisa, those are people killed during the revolution. And fortunately, at least the people who did committed the crime were identified. And this is one of the problems. Many people killed, and you cannot identify who did that. But on those cases where the people are identified, they are now on trials. It is maybe a slow process. But I think this is the type of justice we want to do. We want a full trial. We want the ordinary judicial system to do that. We didn't have a special court for such things as the old regime used to do. And we give full right to those accused to have lawyers, to have time for the lawyers to examine the case. So this is how justice is done. I know it is sometimes slow, and maybe the people don't like that. They want to find a very fast trial, but I think fast trial will not be a just trial. A bit patient for justice to be done. At the same time, people want to cooperate, because you know, in many cases that is on trial, the court sometimes they don't have enough evidence. So we call on people who have some information to come and appear on this course and to give their information that they have. Maybe it is slow, we know that. Also, one of the problems we have problems with the Attorney General office is always complaining of not having enough people to work with them. We have people with the judicial, we have problems with the judicial system, which also inherited from the old regime, but we are working hard to deal with these problems.
And my final question, those that look at what's going on in Sudan argue that Sudan is being influenced by regional actors. Sudan plays a pivotal role in the Saudi-led war on Yemen, and there's clearly Saudi and Emirati influence within the military council. How does Sudan chart an independent foreign policy while these regional actors have such vested interest in the Republic of Sudan?
That's true. I mean, part of this situation was inherited. For example, the involvement of Sudanese army in Yemen was inherited from the old regime. And we are trying to find a way to finish that. We are concerned with what happened in Yemen. We are also concerned what's happening in Saudi Arabia. But involving directly in a war is not the right thing to do, and to help the situation to be solved, the crisis in Yemen. We have a very long relationship with Saudi Arabia, but at the same time, we don't think sending army is the right way to help Saudi or Saudi Arabia or to help Yemen. So we are trying to deal with such situation, at least to reach a point where we can pull the Sudanese army from Yemen and try to play a positive role in solving the crisis in Yemen. And you know what's happening in Libya, what's happening in South Sudan, what is happening now in Ethiopia. We are living in a very difficult areas in the world, it's a very difficult situation where the countries around Sudan have a lot of problems. And that puts Sudan within different axes. From day one, we say that we want Sudan to be independent and we to have independent foreign policies, but also that cannot happen in a moment. We are aware of that. We are aware that Sudan is considered part of the Saudi Emirates axe. We want Sudan to be very independent in its foreign policy and having a normal relationship with all countries. And now I think the relationship with Qatar has improved a bit, and we hope that we are going to improve it more so we can have the normal relationship with all countries. But one of the main things people of Sudan ask for is this foreign independent foreign policy. And I think during the transition, we are moving, maybe slowly, but we are moving towards that.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC. On the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.